But let's read it together, Genesis 35, starting in verse 16. Then they moved on from Bethel. While they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. And as she was having great difficulty in childbirth, the midwife said to her, "Don't despair, for you have another son." As she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named her son Ben-Oni. But his father named him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. Over her tomb, Jacob set up a pillar. And to this day, that pillar marks Rachel's tomb. Israel moved on again and pitched his tent beyond Migdal-Eder. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, and Israel heard of it. Jacob had 12 sons. The sons of Leah, Reuben, the firstborn of Jacob, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. The sons of Rachel's servant, Bilhah, Dan, and Naphtali. The sons of Leah's servant, Zilpah, Gad, and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Jacob came home to his father Isaac in Mamre, near Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. Isaac lived 180 years. Then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. This is the word of the Lord. So I was about 11, 12-ish years old when I stood on top of the Martensen Monument in Bastogne, Belgium. My scout troop had spent a very rainy, sort of cold Belgium-y day traveling around looking at the landscape where the World War II Battle of the Bulge took place. And I was there on top of this, the Martensen Monument, if you've never been to Belgium, if you've been there, it looks out over sort of the fields where parts of this battle took place, and it's in the shape of a huge five-pointed star, sort of like you would have seen on the side of a World War II American airplane. And when I was there, there are all sorts of monuments in this spot, and there's a sort of crypt in the bottom, but you can go up on top and look around. And when I was there, even as a kid, even as an 11 or 12-year-old or whatever I was, maybe, I think probably 11, looking over the landscape are more than 75,000 Americans. This is not even counting the Englishmen that were involved, or the, this is my nod to Max, the Englishmen that were involved, or even the Germans that were killed. Just an unbelievable loss of life during that battle, the bloodiest battle in World War II, as it relates to the Americans at least. Over 75,000 Americans killed or injured or missing. And even as an 11-year-old kid, I stood on top of that monument and just thought, something significant happened here. I mean, you read the placards, you sort of see some of the pictures in the museum, you hear the stories, and I just thought, you know, I can't leave this spot. Maybe I was just an old man as an 11-year-old, but I thought, I can't leave this spot as though nothing changed in me, right? Because something significant happened there, and it has, even as a military kid growing up around the military. I have this palpable memory that day changed the way that I thought about war, even. There's certain monuments or memorials, certain sorts of remembrances that can shape us in that kind of a way. For me, that was one of them. Well, believe it or not, this is, in fact, the last Jacob sermon. And it might seem like an odd place to stop, because usually when you go through the life of Jacob or the life of somebody, you sort of find out about their death. But in the story cycles of Genesis, this is actually the end of Jacob's time. He'll pop up again in the Joseph account later on, but he's really sort of a secondary player in those places, really much more focused on something else. So this is, in a sort of a literary way, he ends here. There are certain markers, literary markers in Genesis that brings this part to an end. So I think, though, as weird as it may seem to say, life of Jacob, and he's still alive, it's actually kind of fitting to end his part of the story with this kind of odd sort of mishmash of passages. For this reason, what we've seen in our passage this morning is really a summary of what we've seen already. The kinds of things that are happening in this passage are the kinds of things that we've seen throughout our series on Jacob. Throughout a lot of wild scenarios, a lot of really weird things that have happened, a lot of really tragic things that have happened, in all of this sort of story cycle of Jacob, we've seen God's faithfulness to his covenant promises at every step of the way. And here we are at the end of his story cycle, and we get to remember the kinds of scenarios that the Lord has been faithful in already. For example, there's tragedy. right? Jacob's favorite wife. She wanted another son. Do you remember that back when she was having kids and that whole passage about kids being born? In this account, you know, she has Joseph and she says, "May the Lord add to me another son." And she waited and waited and waited and waited. And here the Lord provides her with another son, except that she dies in childbirth. It's a tragic situation. And you also see in this passage, you might have noticed that, you know, that's the only time Jacob names a kid. So here he is, son of my right hand. And perhaps that's a sign of Jacob's growth. It's sort of, we see other signs that maybe he hasn't gotten as far as we might want him to. But in any event, Benjamin becomes a major part of how Jacob ends up being provided for by Joseph in Egypt. The Lord's faithful, even in the midst of tragedy. Now there's also, as we've seen in the Jacob story so far, there's this really strange passage about dishonor when Reuben takes his father's concubine. And it actually was probably a political move on Reuben's part. Because you remember, so Rachel's gone, and his mom was Leah. By defiling Bilhah, Rachel's servant, he's making sure that Leah's the next in line for honor. Sort of a weird thing to do from our standpoint, but it would be weird for us to have four wives and all that too. So here we have this sort of political move where Reuben is trying to take care of his mom in a weird sort of a way. And we already know, again, Leah was easy to overlook for Jacob. So you might even understand some of the weirdness in there. But it's also a usurpation of Jacob's authority as father. And would later on, we would see if we kept plugging along through Genesis, that Reuben receives this sort of anti-blessing because of what he's done. But through this strange, sad, bad event, the honor of the firstborn, which should have been Reuben, makes its way over Simeon and Levi because of what they did. And you know where it lands? On Judah. So the promise of this king that's coming gets on Judah. It's a part of God's faithfulness. Because now it sort of starts to make sense of the line of the tribe of Judah. You guys have heard this before. You get to Judah because of this bad event. Now there's also a little run-of-the-mill kind of stuff. We get this short genealogy. It's not flashy, but it's there. But it's also evidence that the Lord has said he's going to provide for Jacob a company of nations. We're still seeing God's faithfulness in these different kinds of events. And then at the very end, we see God's faithfulness in a good, solid ending. Right? Isaac lives a good long life. I like the term. He's old and full of days, and he's sort of gathered to his people. He's buried in the family plot, really the only piece of ground that Abraham had bought in Canaan. Isaac's buried there. But make sure we notice that at the end of this, it's almost like a Lifetime movie ending. We get to the end of this, and here at Isaac's death, who's with him? Well, Jacob and Esau, restored to one another. Right? Remember that happened a few sermons back. Here they are together. They're restored. They're not fighting. Esau's not trying to kill Jacob. Jacob's not trying to run away. But there they are standing there burying their father. And what we see is that through a variety of very different kinds of circumstances, just like we've seen all along already, the Lord keeps keeping his promises. He's always faithful, always faithful, always faithful, no matter what the circumstances are. Now, it's good to say the Lord is faithful. The Lord keeps his covenant forever. But we also have the question, so now as we get to the end of the life of Jacob, what are we supposed to do with all that, really? Well, I think as we look back over the scope of our series, there is some help with that. Think back to big, significant events in the life of Jacob so far. Something significant happens, and what does Jacob do? Right? Jacob has his big ladder vision at Bethel. What did he do? Jacob has, you know, the peace accords with Laban. And what did they do? After Jacob was finally passed the Esau conflict, which is an important part of the story, what did he do? After the Lord revisited Jacob's name change to Israel, what did he do? After Rachel died in childbirth, what did he do? In each of these places, we see a memorial being set, a remembrance, a pillar, an altar of some kind being set up, a way to remember these highly significant events. It happens over and over again. Now, the idea of memorializing significant event, we're going to get someplace, by the way, don't worry. Just try to hang on. It's sort of, this is, I should have said, it's kind of a weirder sermon. It's sort of fallen out in a different way than is typical, so hopefully we'll get to the end and you'll know what's going on. But anyway, memorializing, we do some of that today, right? I mean, think about public examples. For example, in Oklahoma City, there's a bombing memorial. If you've not been there, it's actually a great memorial. Maybe on a more individual level, we might set up a special tombstone over a loved one. Or this is Madison, so people get memorial tattoos all the time, right? So you think of ways that we remember. And I would suggest that as Moses is writing, as he's writing for a people somewhere in between Egypt and Canaan, this very text that we're reading is a memorial. It's a way to make sure that it doesn't get forgotten, to make sure that the things that the Lord has done don't slip away from our memories. At the ends of all these significant events, we see remembrance. Now, why is remembering so important? And maybe especially sort of formal-ish remembering. Well, let's think for a few minutes about how remembering, especially formal remembering, shapes us. And I think we can track how this remembering functions in a few ways. First of all, there's just the repetition of the data, right? The repetition of the information. When we remember, it's the data that gets recalled. And you might even think about this. The piece of land that we're dealing with in these accounts of Jacob is not very big. So for a people that are roaming around the countryside with flocks, they're going to see these pillars again. They're going to see these stones, these monuments, often. And as they go by them, there's a sense in which the data of the memorial gets remembered, right? If a couple guys are riding by on their camels, they see Rachel's pillar, they know, hey, you know what happened there? Rachel died, right? Right, Rachel died. So there's a sense, there's more than that, we'll see in a minute, but there's a sense in which these remembrances that we participate in are repeating the data. They're getting the information back in us. So now we have recurring memorial events in our own lives. In the Old Testament, there's the Passover. It happened every year, right? We have these seasons that we go through, things Advent, Lent, Easter, a weekly memorial in the Lord's Supper. At one level, these memorial events function to repeat a certain set of facts. God rescues. Jesus was born. Jesus died. Jesus rose again. These data points. God is faithful. And we need these data points to be rattling around in us regularly. But sometimes just having the information, maybe often, having the information doesn't actually shape our hearts, though. Because it could be that we come to these memorial events, even, and we do it over and over again, and we see the data, or we think about the data points, and it can become not much more than, you guys remember, like in junior high, you're in your history class, and you make a timeline? You know, you get your big piece of poster board, and you put it on there, and you've got the line, and there's Constantine and Charlemagne, and you're going to go down the line, and, you know, they're all on there. It's like just points on a line. And my guess is that none of you have gone, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, yes, I'm a new man, right? In some ways, these data points, they're there and we need them in there, but they may not actually shape us. And what we need in a right kind of remembering, we want more than the data. We want our hearts to be moved. And so there's a second way. Not only do we have in memorializing the repetition of the data, but there's a second way that remembering shapes us. Now, good remembering does this. It also sets the context for the data, right? There are these bits of information that we need, but good memorializing, if you want to use that term, it also provides a story for the data to sit within so that we can understand the significance of it. I mean, so going back to our example, a couple guys ride by Rachel's pillar on their camels. It's not like they go, Rachel's pillar, hey, she's dead. Let's go. Who wants a falafel, right? It's not that. As they would go by the pillar, this is Rachel's pillar. There's a story that goes with Rachel's pillar, right? Rachel, Jacob's favored wife, suffered in childbirth. She died. She died giving birth to Benjamin. And there's this whole story that gets evoked in a right kind of remembering. Good remembering evokes the context of the event so we can see the reason. Why is it even worth remembering? So, I mean, for example, this big star-shaped monument in Bastogne that I mentioned, it's not just the people in Belgium thought, hey, we need a big star in the field. But when you stand on when you stand on that monument, there's this story around it, the Allied defense of Belgium, right? Trying to protect Belgium from the Nazi movement at great cost. There's a story behind it. Rachel's Pillar pointed out that God was faithful when Rachel died. He provided a son, right? Good remembering gets at the story as well as the data. Or maybe take another example, probably a good example for us because we do this week after week. Take the Lord's Supper as an example. When we go to this memorial action each week, we aren't just receiving data points, right? Jesus said, eat and drink. He did. Or even Jesus died, although he did. That's good information. We need that. But we also remember more fully that on the night when Jesus was betrayed, he took bread and giving thanks, and all those are the things that we say week after week. It's not just the information. It's that it sits within a story that we remember, and we start to see that these data points, Jesus said, eat and drink, Jesus died, they're significant to us because they're set within a series of events that demonstrates their weight and shows how our lives intersect with it. Jesus was placing himself in the Passover story as the Lamb who averts God's judgment for a bunch of people that were about to walk away. Good remembering sets the context for the events we memorialize. And one of the challenges, though, is even when we talk about the data, and even as we talk about sort of the context, one of the challenges with remembering, though, is that sometimes even the story can be just another layer of data. It can just be another layer of information, but it doesn't have to be that way, and it's actually not supposed to be that way. Now, a thorough remembering calls us to do something. I'll give you an example. I mentioned the Oklahoma City National Memorial. I don't know why this is on my mind this week, but at the Oklahoma City National Memorial, which is a memorial for the bombing, you guys, it's, you know, 1995, truck bomb goes off at the Alfred P. Murrow Building. And the whole city's changed. I mean, Danielle and I were there when it happened. I was sitting in a class at the junior college and heard it and thought it was an airplane. And then came outside of the commons, and the whole school was huddled around this one little TV on a rolling cart. But they built this monument, and it's on either side of the grounds where the building stood. And there are twin gates. And on one gate, there's the marking 901. And that marking represents sort of the time before it happened, right? And then there's the monument in the middle, a big reflecting pool, 168 empty chairs. And on the other side, there's another gate. They call them the Gates of Time. And it's marked with 903. So when you stand in there and you're looking at the empty chairs, and as you look in the pool, the reflecting pool is this black granite with a thin layer of water over the top that's constantly running. And the idea is that you're supposed to see the reflection in the pool of someone who was changed by what happened in this moment in time, right? 901, 903. The bomb went off at 9:02, and you stand there in this monument, and you're not just going, hey, a bomb went off at 9:02. You're standing there, and you're involved in the story. You become a participant. You see your own reflection in the pool. You're in this second of time when everything, at least for that city, changed dramatically. You know, whether you were there in that moment, whether you stood at the building when the truck bomb exploded, whether you were there or not, in that memorial, in that remembrance, you become a participant, right? It's not just data that you can now recite, you know, at the next trivia night. And it's not even just that you got the story. There was this guy who did these things. It's that when you're really remembering, you're entering into the story, you're becoming a participant, such that, like the old hymn, right, you can say at that point, you know, this is actually my story. I'm a part of this. Now, thinking back to the Lord's Supper, we're going to work our way back towards Jacob, but thinking back to the Lord's Supper, we find our spot in the story as one of those who abandoned Jesus. We're the kinds of folks that abandon him, but by virtue of his great grace, we can still find a place in his mercy because his body was broken. His blood was poured out. We don't have to live as enemies of God anymore because of what we remember in the bread and in the juice. Now, none of you were there in the upper room. None of you, right? Right. None of you were there in the upper room. But week after week, we become participants in what actually happened. the more we're able to see ourselves as participants in the story, the more we're able to see how the Lord's not only faithful to Jacob in such an odd variety of circumstances, but he's also faithful to me in my tragedy. He's also faithful to me in my times of dishonor. He's also faithful to me in my very ordinariness, which is most of my life. And he's also faithful to me in my good ends, too. You see, he's always faithful. He's always faithful to me because the covenant promises have come to me, you know, through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, through Jesus, and now to me. It really is our story. We really are participants in this life of the patriarch. Now, but to get to that kind of participation, we actually need deeply rooted remembrances. We need these daily individual remembrances that occur in things like prayer and meditating on the scriptures. We need that. But we also need these corporate and more formal remembrances through our liturgies, through the sacraments, through our shared life together. That kind of stuff makes for good, deep remembering. The kind that gets past the data and even past the story to a real participation. Now, I remember reading an article some time back. You may know the name. Rich Mullins was a Christian songwriter. And he wrote this magazine article about how one night he was outside in a field and realized, he's sort of looking up, marveling at the stars, and realized, hey, those are the same stars that Jacob slept under. When Jacob's head was on a stone for a pillow, when he was doing all that, he looked up at the same stars that Rich Mullins was looking up in that moment. That night sky was full of the same kinds of lights in the heavens that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob saw. And I have to confess that thought has stuck with me. It sort of bubbles up in my mind somewhat often. But you know, the reason why is because it means that the story that we've been reading about over these last number of weeks about Jacob and the Lord's faithfulness to his covenant promises and how Jacob was never abandoned, even in the midst of some crazy circumstances like the ones we've read about today, God was faithful to Jacob in this place. The same world that Jacob traipsed around on, that's the one that we traipsed around on. God's faithfulness to Jacob, it's not some separate, otherworldly sort of story thing. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a myth. Jacob slept under these stars, under this sky. The same God that was faithful to him is the God that's faithful to us. We are truly, really participating in the same story that Jacob was. The Lord's commitment to his covenant promises is played out on the stories of this place and these lives just as much as it was played out thousands of years ago to Jacob. So now that we've come to the end of our Jacob series, and we read these stories, I guess we're sort of faced with the decision then. Are these just data points? Is it just Bible trivia that we can answer now? Or are we really a participant in this story of God's faithfulness? Are we really involved in this? Are we living in light of God's faithfulness? Are we able to appropriate these examples of the Lord's faithfulness in such a way that we can actually sing, "Here I raise my Ebenezer, here thereby thy help I've come"? And my hope is that the answer is, you know, yes. Jesus sought me when a stranger wandering from the fold of God. My hope is that we don't get to the end of Jacob and go, "Nice story." My hope is that we get to the end of this sort of cycle of Jacob and say, "I'm going to participate with the same faithful God that was faithful to Jacob all those many years ago." God's faithfulness is such that I think it beckons us to do just that. So let's do that this morning as we turn our attention to this memorial. But first, let me pray. Father in heaven, you have been good. And not just to Jacob in his circumstances, but to us in ours. Lord, as I've wrestled with this passage, I've wrestled with a lot of Jacob passages, Lord. I'm kind of glad we're getting past Jacob for a while. But Lord, it's kind of a weird sermon, I get that. But I really, really pray, as I was praying a lot throughout the day yesterday, that Lord, we would be a people that learn how to remember, to really be participants in your faithfulness, But thank you so much that you're calling people like us to do just that. So as we turn our attention to the Lord's table, may this be a time that we truly remember. Strengthen us for that end, pray in Jesus' name. Amen.